Hello again. According to the ancient historian Cassius Dio, one day the Roman Emperor Hadrian was hurrying along a road when he was approached by a woman who shouted out that she had a petition that she wanted to present to him. Hadrian replied that he was too busy to stop, at which the woman angrily shouted out, "Then you should stop being emperor." This little anecdote raises interesting questions about what the expectations were for an emperor, at least in terms of his duties and the obligations that he owed to the citizens whom he ruled over. Now, of course, in this anecdote, Hadrian, who is a good emperor and is very hardworking, immediately stopped, turned back, and listened to the woman's concerns, although one's tempted to be a bit skeptical of such a positive outcome in the majority of cases. In this lecture, I want to explore this issue of government and administration for both the Roman and the Chinese empires. First, I'll focus on the structure of the administration and the identity and training of the people who function as imperial bureaucrats. And second, I want to begin to consider the man at the top, the emperor himself. In regards to administration, Rome and China form a very interesting comparison, because both empires are renowned for having maintained successful and long-lasting political hegemony over huge empires. However, the methods by which they did this were very, very different. And the most obvious difference between the two is in the size of the imperial bureaucracy. Both administrations had to oversee about 55 million people spread out over about 1.5 million square miles. Han China did that with a very formally defined, rigid hierarchy of 120,000 government bureaucrats. Rome, on the other hand, did that same thing with fewer than 200 senior administrators, though they were informally assisted by a network of maybe 30,000 friends, clients, slaves, and local elites. So, you could argue that in Han China, there was about one administrator for every 450 people, whereas in Rome, there was only one formal administrator for every 250,000 people. Let's begin with the organization of the Han government. Overall, the Han administration was really a paragon of clarity and organization. So at the very top were the emperor, his family, and the imperial court. And we'll look at those in more detail a little bit later. Next were three officials who were known as senior statesmen. And their real role was to serve as intermediaries between the emperor and his court and the rest of the government. And because of that, they play a key role in setting policy in general. Next, there was a level of 9 ministers. And each one of those was the head of a different major division of government, such as religion, the economy, foreign affairs, transportation, the law, security, finance, and the palace. And then beneath those were 20 descending grades of government officials, arranged in a strict hierarchy from highest down to lowest. Every single one of those grades had a specific salary, which ranged from 10,000 bushels of wheat per year for the top highest level down to just 100 bushels of wheat per year for the most junior level of bureaucrats. Each grade had a specific seal that they would use to stamp or mark documents. And they would also carry this as a visible symbol of their status. Each level would wear a sash of a certain color, which also would immediately tell you what level bureaucrat they were. And these were career bureaucrats. They would start at the bottom, and each one would hope to rise through the ranks as high as they possibly could get. They got one day out of every 6 as vacation. And when they retired, they could hope to get one-third of their ordinary salary as a kind of pension. Entrance into that hierarchy was gained by passing the civil service examinations. And remember, in theory, those are open to all candidates. And so they offered an important route of potential social mobility. In practice, though, the only people who could really afford the huge amounts of time and leisure to study the Confucian classics that formed the basis of those exams were fairly wealthy landowners. And they tended to be the local elite. So the bureaucratic class of China was drawn primarily from the ranks of this sort of landed gentry. The Imperial Academy, the sort of university set up by Wu Ti, functioned as a feeder of well-prepared candidates for the civil service exams. And Chinese literature is absolutely stuffed full of stories which revolve around success or failure at these civil service exams. Often these stories involve pairs of childhood friends, one of whom passes the exams and the other of whom fails them. And as a result, subsequently, they have very divergent life paths. Candidates could take exams over and over again. So sometimes these stories will feature an initially unsuccessful candidate who eventually then goes on to a stellar career. And a great many of these exam stories have what we might call humorous punchlines. For example, one well-known story concerns two men from the same village who were named Peng and Zhan. And of course, they're married to a pair of sisters. Peng passes the exams the first time he takes them, and he becomes a high-status official and becomes very full of himself. But Zhan fails. Humiliated, he then devoted himself to study, and after many years, he too eventually passed the exam. Well, as the story goes, Peng one day was riding a donkey through the countryside when news reached him of his old rival's success. And he was so astonished to hear that he had finally passed the exam that he fell out of the saddle. Well, as a result, the following little couplet became popular in their district. And it goes, "When Zhan the exams did pass, Peng fell off his ass." In terms of geographic organization, China during the Han period was divided up into between 80 and 100 provinces. Sometimes you'll see these called commanderies. These in turn were subdivided into 1,500 regions, sometimes called counties. And at the lowest level of administration, the village officials were responsible for doing almost everything, collecting taxes, enforcing imperial edicts, keeping accurate records, the most important of which was the land register, which showed who owned what. Now, we'll look at the Chinese military in another lecture, but senior generals were directly appointed by the emperor, and they held stipends and rank just below the level of the nine ministers. Overall, the Chinese system is one of perfect clarity and organization. Everyone has precisely defined duties and responsibilities, and the status distinctions between all the officials are clear and public. Remember, underlying this entire system was the ethical code of conscientious duty, which was derived from Confucian legalist doctrine. And with its emphasis on selfless service, on obedience, and as always trying to act as a positive role model, this ethos was cultivated as a way to try and curb governmental corruption. And the system of civil service exams performed an important function in identifying individuals who had talent and then harnessing their abilities and energy in the service of the state. And it's vital to have some sort of mechanism like that to bring new talent into the government and to prevent frustrated individuals from being tempted to use their talent and their skills to instead undermine the central authority. When we turn to the administration of the Roman Empire in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, we see a very, very, very different picture. The Roman bureaucracy is much less pre-planned. It was really just a jumbled assemblage of ad hoc positions and offices that had kind of organically developed as Rome expanded. And it made a lot more use of informal agents to flesh out the lack of formal bureaucratic officials. The Romans, as always, are obsessed with tradition, and so they're very reluctant to innovate. And this stubbornness at times could be one of their great strengths, but it could also be a weakness. And we see this clearly in the case of imperial administration. So for centuries, the Romans labored to run this enormous far-flung empire with a bureaucracy that had really been designed just to run a single city. And it's only with the greatest reluctance that they add new magistrates to the existing system. By the late 1st century AD, the Roman Empire consisted of about 50 provinces. And each of those was run by an administrator who, in essence, acted as a kind of governor for that province. Now, technically speaking, there were really two separate types of provinces. There were senatorial provinces, and in these, the governor was called a proconsul, and he was appointed by the Senate. Provinces, however, which had a large military presence in them, a big army, were called imperial provinces, and these were governed by a man called a legate, and he was a direct appointee of the emperor. Most senatorial provinces also had a quaestor, who was a magistrate in charge of financial stuff. And finally, some senatorial and imperial provinces, though not all of them, had one or more assistants to the governor known as procurators. So, in a senatorial province, the formal state-appointed bureaucrats might just consist of three men: the proconsul, the quaestor, and the procurator. Well, obviously, three men is not enough administrators to run a huge region. And so this gap was filled, first of all, by the fact that each one of those formal administrators would have come out to the province with a huge retinue of personal assistants. Some of these might have been provided by the state, but most of them were drawn from the ranks of his friends, his clients, his slaves, and his freedmen. And so in the same way that the informal institution of the patronage system played an important role in Roman social relations, so also these informal bureaucrats played an important role in Roman political administration. Secondly, the Romans liked to make extensive use of local elites who could then control their own population. So tribal leaders, local town councilmen, local aristocrats, all of these were people who would be cultivated by the Romans and really pressed into service by them as proxies for the Romans. And often these are the very same sorts of people who had been in control before the Romans took over a region. And so now, effectively, they continue to wield local power while, of course, paying deference to the greater power of Rome. And in many ways, this is an efficient system. After all, a local leader is going to be the person who has the greatest knowledge of local problems and probably how to solve them as well. And they would have all the personal connections to facilitate that sort of thing. At least early on, this minimalist approach to administration was also made possible by, in essence, farming out many things that we think of as governmental functions to private concerns. For example, especially during the Roman Republic, the majority of taxes were not collected by government officials, but instead they were collected by private corporations who would bid to get the contract to collect taxes in a certain region. Due to the constraints on communication I talked about in the last lecture, governors obviously had to exercise a large amount of autonomous power. But nevertheless, they would always at least try to consult with the central authority as much as was possible. And the form this often took was direct correspondence with the emperor. And a really fascinating insight into the workings of Roman administration can be gained from a set of over 100 surviving letters, which were written between the Emperor Trajan and one of his provincial governors in Asia Minor, a man named Pliny the Younger. One of the surprising aspects of this correspondence is how Pliny the governor seeks Trajan, the emperor's, advice even on incredibly trivial matters. as when Pliny bothers the ruler of the entire Roman world with a request for permission to cover over a stinky sewer that runs through the forum of some obscure provincial town. And in Trajan's replies, you can sometimes get a sense of mild annoyance with this sort of minutiae with which Pliny's letters are pestering him. For example, in reply to a letter concerning requests by some Greek cities to build various public works, we have a reply by Trajan. And he says, "My dear Pliny, you are on the scene and can best determine what should be done about the theater at Nicaea. Just let me know what you decide." Clearly, he would have preferred that many of these issues were handled locally. And Pliny also has an unfortunate penchant for asking Trajan to send experts from Rome out to solve problems in his province. And often Trajan politely but very firmly declines these petitions, as when later in the very same letter he says, "You decide what to advise the people of Claudiopolis about the bath which they have begun on what seems to me a very unfortunate site. There must be local architects. Every province has its share of skillful professionals. Do not always assume that the quickest solution is to get help from Rome. Most architects come from Greece anyway." The Roman reliance on local elites and on city councils means that many Roman cities are effectively self-governing. And so the Roman approach to government here is exactly the opposite of the Chinese one. In Han China, the officials who were sent out by the state to rule over an area were intentionally chosen so as not to be from that region. So these detached state agents were thought to provide a more objective administration than if the bureaucrats had been drawn from that region. And that would mean they might be enmeshed in local rivalries and have local prejudices. Also, whereas many low-level governmental positions in China, things like clerks, record keepers, these were all filled by professional salaried officials. But those same sorts of jobs in the Roman Empire tend to be handled by public slaves, which were owned collectively by a city or a community. There was a kind of basic similarity between the two administrations, however, and that is that the class from which the main administrators were drawn was moderately to very wealthy landowning families. Those were the ones who most frequently took the civil service exams in China, and almost all the higher-ranking Roman officials were exclusively drawn from a group of traditional, landowning, aristocratic families. So whereas we might term China's officials scholar bureaucrats, in a sense, Rome's were amateur gentlemen administrators. And in a lot of ways, these officials of Rome are analogous to the class of well-educated, aristocratic, gentlemen landowners that Victorian Britain drew upon to administer its colonial empire. And if the ideology that underlay Chinese bureaucracy was Confucianism legalism, upper-class Roman administrators were motivated by that old Roman pursuit of status in the form of dignitas. Now, over time, the Roman administration slowly became a little bit more like the Chinese one. It grew larger, it grew more rigid, and it became somewhat more logically organized. In particular, there were a whole series of reforms in the late 3rd century AD, which resulted in a sweeping reorganization of the provinces. And at the end of that, there were now 100 standardized provinces, which were grouped into 4 bigger districts, and there was a very substantial increase in the number of formal bureaucrats. That same reform also separated the civilian and the military commands. Let's turn now to the top administrator himself, the emperor, and look a little bit at his role in all of this. In both Rome and China, emperors who were by nature energetic, such as Wu Ti, or even just dedicated, like Vespasian, could exert their authority to very dramatic effect. After all, they have total power, and their will could mobilize huge armies and send them off to conquer new lands, as when Trajan invaded Dacia. Or they could begin gigantic construction projects, as when Xu Huangdi erected the earliest version of the Great Wall. In both empires, maybe one of their most important functions, though, was the direct or indirect influence that they had in appointing senior administrators and generals. While the theoretical power of these rulers seems nearly unlimited, in reality, they were always struggling against those time and distance constraints on communication described earlier. After all, how much control could even an absolute monarch wield over a distant province, when the most basic information from there took 3 months to reach him? And the answer is obviously very little. So this is where the structure of the state bureaucracy had to step in and really deal with most local issues all on its own. And as we saw with Pliny and Trajan, most decisions were best made locally. And emperors, really whether they wanted to or not, had to rely heavily on the judgment of their subordinates. If, on the one hand, though, an emperor's powers were limited by distance, on the other hand, they could very actively control their immediate surroundings. And those people who found themselves within the range of the emperor's sight and within the range of his voice were truly under his sway. And this was a condition that could be alternatively beneficial or disastrous, depending on the personality of a given ruler. The inhabitants of the capital city of Rome often benefited greatly from the emperor's presence in their midst, so he would grant them all kinds of benefactions. Some of these include the famous grain dole, by which each citizen in Rome received a free monthly distribution of grain supplied by the state. The people who lived in Rome were regularly treated to extravagant public spectacles, ranging from chariot races to giant mock naval battles fought on artificial lakes with thousands of combatants. On the other hand, proximity to a bad or a crazy emperor could be a very, very dangerous situation. The senators were frequent targets for the wrath of such emperors. Even common people in Rome could unexpectedly fall victim to their outbursts. For instance, at some games in Rome, Caligula, once just entirely on a whim, ordered an entire section of the audience thrown into the arena to be eaten by wild animals. And if you were one of those unfortunates who suddenly found yourself transformed from a spectator into the entertainment itself, well then, living in proximity to the emperor had exacted a fatal price. Some emperors plainly found their relative lack of control over affairs outside the capital troubling, and tried to do something about it. Hadrian, one of the good emperors of the 2nd century AD, tried to exercise better personal supervision of the empire, as we've seen, by literally taking to the road. So he spent much of his reign engaged on those grand tours, traveling throughout the provinces, accompanied by the entire imperial court. And in that way, he hoped that he could at least bring his personal attention to every corner of the empire, at least occasionally, as he rotated through all the different provinces. Hadrian's perambulations around the Roman Empire have an interesting parallel in the grand tours undertaken by various Chinese emperors, such as Xu Huangdi. The first emperor made 5 of these great journeys throughout his reign, and he visited a different region in China each time. And these trips served a lot of the same purposes as Hadrian's tour. They enabled the emperor to personally assess each region, to sort of check in on its problems, and to see if local officials were doing their jobs. In China, though, these imperial trips had an important additional purpose. If you look at Xu Wangdi's itinerary, it was largely dictated by his desire to visit various sacred spots and to perform rituals personally at them. And this was a lot more than just displaying his piety to the gods. It was intimately linked to the Chinese concept of the emperor ruling by virtue of the divine mandate and approval of heaven. And the actual performance of those rituals was simultaneously a means of ensuring and really advertising that mandate. Similarly, Hadrian's trips had a purpose that was uniquely Roman in its context. And it's another thing that reveals a profound difference between how Rome and China looked at their respective rulers and what their jobs were. In the Roman world, it was vital for the emperor to be seen, to be visible in a literal sense by his subjects. This need goes all the way back to the republican origins of Roman society, in which the leaders of the state were elected by the people, by the citizens. Now, in the empire, the people of Rome were no longer voting. They no longer had the power to elect their ruler, the emperor. But they still had the power to symbolically approve of his legitimacy through their shouted acclamations. So when he appeared in the street, they would chant approval of him. And in order for this to happen, there had to be frequent opportunities for large numbers of ordinary citizens to interact publicly with the emperor. And this at least partially explains why the emperors built huge arenas, such as the Colosseum or the Circus Maximus, and then filled them with free spectacular entertainments. Because it was in those kinds of places that they could appear before the adoring crowds and receive public acknowledgement of their status as emperor in the form of applause, cheers, and chanted slogans. In a very literal sense, it's the massed shouts of the Roman people hailing a man as emperor that are what make him the legitimate emperor. And this sort of public recognition by the citizens was so fundamental to an emperor's legitimacy that often the very first thing that a new emperor would do upon taking the throne would be to appear at some public games. If we look at the way that Roman cities were built and laid out, they feature large open public spaces, such as the Roman Forum, and those spaces are there to facilitate these sorts of interactions. In Rome, the emperor is supposed to be seen and recognized by his people. If you look at Roman coins, this is why all imperial Roman coins have an image of the emperor's face on them. And it's also why so many portrait busts were carved of Roman emperors. If you go to museums today, they're full of portrait busts of Roman emperors. And the reason for all these is so that even people in remote provinces would maybe have seen one of these portrait busts and would know what their ruler looked like. In China, it's totally different. There, the emperor is a remote figure who is almost never visible to his subjects. If you look at the way Chinese capital cities were built, well, they certainly had big impressive buildings that are associated with the emperor, such as palaces. But they don't have any big open public spaces or venues where the common people could interact with the emperor or even see him. In contrast to those ubiquitous portraits of Roman emperors on every coin and all the portrait busts, there were almost no public images whatsoever of the Chinese emperor. And whereas Hadrian planned his journeys to take him to all the largest cities of the empire where he could be viewed by his subjects, Xu Wangdi's itinerary was focused on visiting shrines, most of which were on desolate, uninhabited mountaintops. In the next lecture, we'll continue this examination of the role and the power of the emperors, as well as looking at how both empires assimilated newcomers and struggled with outsiders. Thank you.